From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Great to be with you. We have a great show for you today. We've got David Simon, the guy who gave us The Wire and Tremé, among other great TV shows. He's coming on later to play Not My Job. But first, disappointing news for Chicago this week. NASA announced who is going to get the retired space shuttles. And once again, L.A., New York, and Washington, and Florida won out over us scrappy Midwesterners. As a consolation prize, though, the Adler Planetarium here in Chicago will get a genuine astronaut simulator. You get inside, all the screens light up, you put on a diaper and pretend to drive all the way to Florida. It's exciting. You can win our prize in the clothes you're wearing, though. Just give us a call. The number is 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hello, this is Matt Wagner from Hagerstown, Maryland.
Hagerstown, Maryland is not far from Washington, right?
Yeah, we're about 80 miles away up in the Appalachian foothills.
Oh, really? So you're in the actual Maryland.
Western Maryland.
All right. Well, welcome to the show, Matt. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello to a writer for the Boston Globe magazine and author most recently of the book Idiot America. Mr. Charlie Pierce is here.
Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Matt.
Next is the deputy editor and a blogger for the Houston Chronicle, Ms. Kiri O'Connor.
Hi, Kiri.
Hi, Matt.
Lastly, it's the man behind the world-famous podcast, Too Beautiful to Live. It's Luke Burbank is here.
Hello,
hey, Matt.
Matt, welcome to the show. You, of course, are going to play Who's Carl this time. That's how we start the show. Carl's going to read you three quotations in the week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain it 2 times out of 3.
Okay.
Ready to play? Here we go.
Yep.
For your first quote, let's hear from Speaker John Boehner.
I won't get rolled.
Turns out he did, at least according to some members of his own party. He did get rolled as he negotiated what big agreement?
The budget agreement.
Yes, indeed. It was last Friday night. And Boehner stayed up late, really late, maybe too late, negotiating a deal with Democrats to keep the government open. And you know how it goes. You get desperate to go home with something before the bar closes. He let his vision get clouded. Experienced political pundits call this effect budget goggles. Boehner trumpeted that he had $39 billion in immediate budget cuts, but the Congressional Budget Office added it all up, and it's really just $350 million in cuts. That's nothing in Washington, $350 million. It's what they put out in a tray next to the Capitol cash register. Need a million? Take a million. No biggie. Once this news came out, the Republicans rebelled. Boehner had to ask the Democrats to help him pass his own bill. They said, fine, fine, just stop sobbing.
Come on, don't you love John Boehner, though? I mean, he's kind of a new kind of Republican. He's, like, emotional, and he's conservative. He's an emoticon.
Nicely done. Well, I mean, were you guys following this? Because some people say that basically Obama tricked them because they thought they had all these budget cuts, but it turns out they're all, for the most part, just accounting gimmicks.
Well, I mean, it's not like he was selling a Toyota Tercel on eBay. You know, they had a chance to do some research.
Yes, that's true.
Like, he tricked them. It isn't like he took some pictures of the budget from flattering angles. Vacuumed
oh, isn't
the carpet
it just like
in the city.
When you meet the budget after communicating online, the pictures are always, always too flattering. It turns out, in addition to all this, we also found out some weird things went into the bill. Did you hear about this? Including legislation that takes the gray wolf off the endangered species list. That's in the bill. You can now shoot gray wolves if you want to. It was a test of wills between the wolves and lobbyists representing Western ranchers. It turns out lobbyists, more bloodthirsty than wolves. And the poor wolves, they don't know how it's done. You know, they put on their suits and they came to Washington, but they just stood outside the Capitol, huffing and puffing, trying to blow it down. It seemed hopeless, but one wolf was out there egging them on, saying, come on, guys, there are 435 pigs in there. We'll eat like kings. Matt, your next quote is part of a game that we call
Getting to Know You,
which we play whenever a new candidate gets into the presidential race, because we like to hear Carl sing. Let's hear from this week's newcomer.
The president and his people spend more time talking about me and Massachusetts health care than Entertainment Tonight spends talking about Charlie Sheen.
And now imagine a smile with perfect teeth. That was from the latest politician to declare his intention of exploring a run for the White House. Who?
Mitt Romney.
Yes, indeed. Mittens the Mittster. He's back. That's the man who looks into the mirror every morning and says to himself, God made me look this way for a reason, so let's get it on. He threw his hair back in the ring this week. Now, Romney's big problem will be the health care law he signed into law in Massachusetts, but really, who cares? Let's talk about Donald Trump. Donald Trump gave an interview to an evangelical radio network this week. Now he's trying to pretend to be a Christian. This is true. He was asked when he goes to church, and his answer was, quote, always on Christmas, always on Easter, and during the Sundays, unquote. Asking Trump about religion, it's like asking Sarah Palin about what she reads. It's like, Mr. Trump, what church do you go to? Oh, you know, all of them. Trump also said he gets mailed a lot of Bibles by supporters, and he said he always puts those Bibles in, quote, a nice place.
Lovely marble fireplace.
It is, exactly. He's very attached to it. But this is the thing. According to some polls, including a recent CNN poll, Trump is either tied or leading the field among potential GOP candidates.
Yeah, the American people are just screwing with us.
Really?
No, they don't care at this point.
They
talk about having to meet somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
On the whole hair thing, Donald Trump, Mitt Romney, there's got to be a bipartisan consensus somewhere in the middle of the between whatever it is that's living on Trump's head and whatever kind of wood Romney made his hair out of.
Right.
Because it looks like the thing that's on Donald Trump's head probably gnaws on the thing that Romney's hair is made of.
Oh, jeez.
All right. Your last quote, Matt, comes from an investigation conducted this week by the Federal Aviation Administration.
He was found intentionally sleeping.
That was FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt. He was describing yet another incident of someone sleeping on the job. What's the job?
Air traffic controller.
Yes, indeed. Most of these guys, you know, are just dozing off. Last week it was revealed an air traffic controller had been caught actually bringing a pillow and blanket to work with him. The man, the bureaucrat overseeing air traffic controllers has resigned. The agency has ended their old policy of providing all overnight controllers with a glass of warm milk.
And a slanket.
New safety policies are being put in place, such as having extra controllers on duty during the midnight shift, banning PBS from control tower TV sets, and preventing controllers from accepting apples from kindly-looking old women. Carl, how did Matt do in our quiz?
Matt had three correct answers, Peter, so Matt, I'll be doing the message on your voicemail.
Well done. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a real fun experience. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Sleeping on the job. Sleeping on the job. Cause me to lose my key. Yeah. Sleeping on the job. Sleeping on the job.
Right now, panel time for you to answer some questions about this week's news. Charlie, during the debate over the budget agreement, which got stuck over federal funding for Planned Parenthood, Senator John Kyle said on the Senate floor that 90% of Planned Parenthood's activities were providing abortion. Turns out that's off by about 87%. When asked why he would say something like that, his spokesman said what?
He said that what Senator Kyle said about Planned Parenthood, quote, was not intended to be a factual statement.
That is correct, Charlie. So what was it intended to be if not a factual statement? Spokesman was asked. A heaping pile of post-digestive bull food, said the spokesman. It turns out that this thing that John Kyle did, perfectly acceptable in the Senate, it's a secret but age-old tradition of Senate oratory. It's believed Daniel Webster invented the not intended to be a factual statement technique during his famous 1847 speech to that body, "I swear to you, good sir, the check is in the post." According to Senate rules, a statement not intended to be factual must be preceded by a big wink to the clerk of the Senate, followed by the whispered warning, "Wait till they get a load of this one." It's a great idea, though. It is so applicable to so many things, this ex post facto explanation. Yeah. I mean, it's like you cheat on your wife. She gets furious at you. She says, "You promised till death do we part." And you're like, "Yes, but that was not intended to be a factual vow." I intended it to be true. I slipped up. I just
have this wonderful vision of Richard Nixon in the political afterlife going, "The only one I didn't think of." "I am not a crook. Not intended
to be a factual statement." Right now it is time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Shelby Hogan from Anaheim, California.
Hey, Anaheim, home of Disneyland?
It is indeed.
Wow, do you live near there?
About 3 miles away.
Wow, do you go a lot?
Actually, I'm on a quest to do everything there is to do at Disneyland in a year, and I'm blogging about it.
Really?
Yeah.
I once spent a solid 5 days there with my wife and three children, who all of whom I love very much. Uh-huh. And if I had to spend another minute there, I would have lost my mind. So don't you have to ration it? Or do you just love it
actually,
that much?
Well, I'm a stay-at-home mom, so I can just pop over for a couple of hours in the afternoon and then come back home.
And out of all...
Wait a minute, I love this. Honey, stay home with the kids. I have to go to Disneyland.
Oh, no, I take them with me.
You take them with you, the kids, right? You just, like, leave them with Ariel or something?
Yeah.
Go on your walk.
Well, you know, actually, I put him on the train, and he just rides around.
That's great. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Shelby, welcome to the show. You're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Shelby's topic?
Mine.
Some things are so familiar, they seem like they've always been there, like sliced bread, your own children. Our panelists, we're going to tell you three stories of people claiming ownership of something we thought nobody owned. Only one of these claims actually was made, though. Choose the true story, and you'll win Carl's voice on your very own home answering machine. Ready to play?
All right.
First, let's hear from Luke Burbank.
By now, most Facebookers have gotten used to the meaningless updates our so-called friends foist on us. Check out these pretend pumpkins I just grew. Hey, watch this cell phone video of my kids' jazz choir singing Eye of the Tiger. I made a salad. And how do we respond to these fascinating dispatches? By clicking on that little thumbs up sign indicating we like it. It's a pillar of Facebook that Cindy DeMuth of Smyrna, Georgia says was stolen from her family. It's bad enough that Siskel and Ebert trademarked something we invented, she says, but this Facebook stuff is just too much. DeMuth claims it was her great-grandfather, Cyril DeMuth, who first used a raised thumb to demonstrate approval or liking of something. In the late 1800s, folks poked their index finger into their lower chin to show approval, she says, but Cyril lost both of his in a cotton gin accident, so he had to improvise. DeMuth's solution, using a thumbs up, was met with confusion. Some folks figured he was insulting them or warning them about a crow's attack, she said. Finally, though, the locals embraced the gesture. DeMuth says she isn't in this for the money. She just wants the record corrected, which is why she started a Facebook petition page titled, "I bet we can find 1 million people who credit Cyril DeMuth with inventing the thumbs up."
A woman from Georgia claims that her ancestor invented that thumbs up gesture indicating approval. Your next story of an unexpected claim comes from Kiri O'Connor.
French food circles were all flutter last week over a surprise discovery and a new point of dubious pride for that food-crazed nation. An unearthed cache of 17th-century letters written by a Gascony noblewoman told of her cook's marvelous new invention. It seems the cook had left some slices of day-old brioche on the stove accidentally until they browned. When she realized her mistake, she simply buttered and served them anyway, passing them off as a new creation. The guests loved the burnt bread, and a food staple was born. Toast. "We want only for the history to be known," said Jean-Marie de la Montaigne, a descendant of the noblewoman. toast. It is part of the French soul, like sex at escargot.
Someone claims to have been descended from the very inventor of toast, and your last story of someone not wanting to share comes from Charlie Pierce.
Certain things have been constant about the game of football since the first account of a game was painted on a cave wall in France. Large men colliding with each other, cheerleaders, drunken revelry in parking lots, and the familiar, annoying da-da-da-da-da-da charge bugle call. To claim royalty for that would seem tantamount to demanding royalties for concussions. However, we all reckoned without Bobby Kent, who is suing because he claims to have written the ditty in 1978 while working as musical director for the NFL San Diego Chargers. Kent claims to have copyrighted the famous five notes as part of a composition called Stadium Doodads, and is suing ASCAP, the musical licensing company, for selling the rights to hundreds of stadiums all over the world without cutting Kent in on the royalties. Experts are divided on the merits of Kent's lawsuit, but reached in England, the heirs to the estate of the late Freddie Mercury were heard to say, we will rock you.
All right. Here are your choices. One of these things is being claimed as a personal invention. From Luke Burbank, was it the thumbs-up sign of approval? From Kerry O'Connor, toast? Or from Charlie Pierce, the familiar da-da-da-da-da charge that you always hear at sports stadiums? Which of these someone claims was invented by them or someone they're related to?
I think I'm going to have to go with the football charge tune.
Da-da-da-da-da. You've heard that, right?
Yes.
Okay, you're going to pick then Charlie's story of that being the subject of someone's claim. Well, we spoke to someone who is involved in this true story.
Mr. Kent was looking for a way to hype the crowd at San Diego Chargers game, and he came up with the ditty.
That's right. That was Richard Wolf, lawyer for Bobby Kent of Miami, Florida, the man who's pressing his, shall we say, quixotic claim to get paid for all the times a stadium organist has played that. Congratulations, Shelby. You got it right. You've earned a point for Charlie. You've won our prize. Carl Castle's voice on your home answering machine. Well done, Shelby.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for playing, Shelby.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I saw it first. It's mine. I had it last. It's mine. Oh, can't you see? It's made for me. It's mine. It's mine. It's mine.
Another game where we ask very accomplished people about trivia. It's called Not My Job. So years ago, David Simon was a police reporter in his hometown of Baltimore. He spent a year with the homicide detectives. That became a book, which became the TV series Homicide. And from there, David created some of the best and most realistic shows ever, such as HBO's The Wire and the series Tremé, which is about to start its second season in HBO. He is also the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. David Simon, welcome to Wait, Wait.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you.
And don't think the MacArthur people aren't appalled.
Oh, I know. I'm sure they go to bed every night tasting nothing but regret.
They see this train wreck about to happen, believe me.
They'll take back the grant. You'll be an ex-genius. Now, one of the things about The Wire, and this is also true, I think, of Tremé as well, is that you do not do a lot to help your audience understand what's going on. I remember when I first started watching The Wire, the plot was complicated. There was language that I didn't understand. I mean, is that intentional? Are you like, you just got to pick it up, or are you just...
For me, and this is going to sound haughty, and I don't mean it to, but for me, when everything's explained, when everything is right there on the surface, I find myself leaning back and becoming disinterested. And I think it's much more interesting to tell a story where you have people leaning towards the television screen trying to think about it.
Even if they're leaning forwards and squinting and going, what the hell is going on?
I have to say, mission accomplished, David, after I spent three solid days watching every season of The Wire in like a fugue state that only Charlie Sheen could rival for non-sleeping and obsessive thoughts.
But did it make sense at the end?
Absolutely, it paid off.
Oh, okay.
One of the things that you're known for, and one of the reasons that I think it's hard to stop watching, is the sense that anything can happen to any of your characters at any time, much like life. In fact,
you know what?
What?
We're in New Orleans, and I've just come off set to do this, and I have to tell you, we're killing one of our characters.
You do that. There's a moment in the third season of The Wire where you kill off maybe the most popular character in the show. I won't spoil it for those who haven't seen it, and I still am shocked Do your actors go, yeah, you're going to hire me. How long are you hiring me?
Yeah, you know, they don't complain a lot.
They don't?
Because yeah. I mean, they don't
want to
end up.
They don't want to get on your bad side.
The cast dynamic is wonderful. Nobody wants to stick their head up and become the squeaky wheel.
Yeah. Know? Oh, yeah. You're going to have a very dramatic ending. People will be shocked.
The trick to making a story matter is that every now and then, somebody you care about has to go. If it's somebody that you don't care about, then it doesn't really have the stakes aren't there. But if you do that every now and then the story matters to people.
So
and there are actual stakes involved, emotional stakes.
So you would like watch Seinfeld, for example, and say, you know, somebody should really shoot George.
Oh, I've actually said that.
Yeah, maybe for different reasons. Before we leave the topic of The Wire, I got to say our single favorite moment. Because these characters almost never leave Baltimore. But there's one moment where two of the drug dealers drive to Philadelphia. And you indicate how incredibly weird and strange Philadelphia is to these guys by they turn on their car radio and they hear, of all things, a Prairie Home Companion.
Right.
And these guys from like inner city Baltimore are like, what the hell is this? What are these people like here? This is terrible.
That actually happened when I was researching the corner. I had a 15-year-old drug dealer in my car from West Baltimore, and I was taking him to meet the editor of the book in New York because I wanted him to, you know, he's 15 years old, he's letting me follow him around. I want him to know it's going to be a real book one day, 2-3 years from now, so I want him to see the publishing house. I want him to know there's no trick here.
Right.
And I want him to be sort of fully informed. So we're on the Delaware Turnpike, and of course, whatever we were listening to, 92Q, you know, the hip-hop station from Baltimore, starts to fade, and in comes an NPR affiliate in Philly. And he's listening to Prairie Home Companion, and he's looking at me like, what is wrong with the rest of the country?
Do you think you could do, like, a gritty, realistic show full of violence and passion about public radio?
I certainly think it would be a challenge.
All right. I got to ask you, MacArthur Genius Grant, how does it feel to be a genius?
How does it feel? Well, ask me after I miss, you know, all three of these next questions.
Yes.
I have everything to lose on this one, as you know.
No. You see, I was talking to
the person you're playing for has everything to lose.
I was
David.
I was talking to David earlier. And David's wife, a very talented writer named Laura Lippman, was on the show some years ago and did really well, got all three right. And for some reason, David, you think of this as like an obstacle?
It just defines a lose-lose situation for me.
And I'm like, well, this is great, because if you win, that's great. And if you lose, you're like, oh, Laura, you're so much smarter than I am. Isn't that wonderful? And she'll be like, that's great. Yes, I am.
Yeah, that's played well as if you're a professional married person.
I am.
I still treasure my amateur status at this.
All right. Well, David Simon, we've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Oh, gee, Mom. Ice cream. How swell.
So, David Simon, your TV shows routinely feature murder, drug use, profanity, public corruption, explicit sex, and we figure we'd ask you about a time when TV refused to admit any of that existed. Answer three questions about nice, wholesome TV of the olden days, or rather answer two of them. We'll ask you three, and you'll win a prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is official genius David Simon playing for?
David is playing for Nancy Rosen of Bozeman, Montana.
All right. You ready?
Uh-huh. So this is TV between the years of 83 and 86,
exactly,
right?
pretty much, mid-80s.
It's all questions about Elf.
Yes. Actually, our first question is about Leave It to Beaver, pretty much the epitome of 1950s wholesome TV. One episode was actually held up for a week by CBS censors. They demanded cuts. What was the shocking content they objected to? A, Mrs. Cleaver kissing Mr. Cleaver on the mouth. B, a full-on, full-frontal shot of a toilet, or C, a shot of Beaver, a young man wearing his tighty-whitey underwear?
Nothing involving Eddie Haskell.
Nothing involving Eddie Haskell in this particular
Shocking.
Case.
Yes. I would have thought Eddie would have brought them to their
sure.
knees. I'm going to go with the toilet.
You're right, sir. It's the toilet. This is somewhat famous in TV history. The episode as shot featured photographs of the whole toilet, and the censors said, no, you can't do that. So they reshot it, so they just showed the toilet tank. And that was the first time any part of a toilet had ever been shown on American television. Right
wow.
then.
I am stunned.
Next question. the early live sitcom, Mary Kay and Johnny, now pretty much forgotten.
What?
Mary Kay and Johnny.
Mary Kay and Johnny?
Mary Kay and Johnny was the name of the show. It was a live show. They did the sitcom live, and they didn't keep any tapes of it, so it's gone. But it made history during its run. How? A, it was the first sitcom to show a married couple sharing a bed. B, one night one of the actors showed up drunk, performed the whole show that way, creating a challenge for the others. Or C, one night one of the actors swore on screen saying, damn, and was fired before the episode was over.
Okay, I'm getting rid of the drunk. I'm passing on that one because I just think, you know, happened many times before.
Sure.
Yeah.
Pretty much since the beginning of entertainment.
I'm going to go with damn.
You're going to go with damn live TV. He said damn, instantly fired. No, it was actually The Bed. It was the first sitcom to show a married couple sharing a bed. And what was weird was this was actually in the late 1940s. Prior, of course, to the famous depiction of Desi and Lucy sleeping in their twin beds. That was, of course, because in 1952, sex was made illegal.
That's right. That's what threw me, is thinking of Desi and Lucy.
I know, it's confusing, but there you go. Now, here you go.
By the way, somewhere Laura Lippman is a very happy lady right now.
Yeah, this is your wife who got three right, which is the show some years
genius,
ago.
Pal.
All right. You see, you didn't have to worry. This is great, though. It's very exciting. So, Father Knows Best, we all know, another classic sitcom of the 50s, and like many other TV shows, it began on the radio. But the radio version was different. How? Was it on the radio that A, Father occasionally gave terrible advice, belying the show's title? B, every episode included Father delivering a speech about the pleasures of smoking? Or C, on the radio, Father would routinely insult his children?
Wow, this, man, TV is way more complicated than I thought it was.
I know. You were doing your simple dramas about people trying to make a living, and now look.
You know, this is morality tales. You know what? Back then on radio, they were such advertisers.
Right.
That I think buried in there is some sort of advertising weirdness in which he was advocating the pleasures of smoking. I'm going with that one.
Okay, that's possible. Let me ask you a question before we reveal this. And it's a serious question. We have discussed the fact that your wife, Laura Lippman, the writer, was on the show some years ago. She got all three right. Would it be better for you to equal that performance, just in terms of your personal life, or not do as well? What would be the better outcome?
Actually, now that I can't get all three correct,
yes,
it would be better if I'm a complete farce.
Right.
And I can give her all the room to be the edumacated, intelligent one.
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay, you're wrong. It's not the smoking. It was that on the radio, Father would occasionally insult the children. He would every now and then call them things like, you stupid children. It was more edgy on the radio. Carl, how did David Simon do in our quiz?
He had one correct answer, Peter, and that is not enough to win for Nancy Rosen.
Oh, I'm sorry. No.
How sad is it that Nancy Rosen loses in David and his wife's domestic working it out?
It's sad.
It's always Nancy in Montana who suffers.
David Simon is the creator of The Wire and Tremé, two of the greatest TV programs you will ever see. The second season of Tremé premieres April 24th in HBO. David Simon, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, sir.
Bye-bye.
We gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.
Thank you so much. Coming up, Carl tries to break his limerick fever by taking two Rhymelinol. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Now, let's go back to the budget battle just for one more minute. Back in December, the president described his Republican opponents as, quote, hostage takers, as they argued over the Bush tax cuts. Then he had to go at it with them again over shutting down the government, and pretty soon we'll have to do it yet again as Republicans threaten to refuse to raise the debt limit. So if these are all truly hostage situations, we thought, on the president's behalf, we should consult an expert. So joining us now is former chief hostage negotiator for the FBI, Gary Noesner. Gary, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. So first, as a professional hostage negotiator, what do you think of President Obama referring to his political opponents as hostage takers?
Well, I suspect the president may have engaged in a little political hyperbole.
You think?
Yeah, it's just a hunch on my part.
So let's take him at his word. Let's say it's a hostage situation. He's dealing with a hostage taker. So if you can give one piece of advice dealing with a hostage taker, what is it?
Well, I think you've got to be genuine and sincere. You know, when someone has a hostage, it's basically a form of extortion. And they're trying to compel you to do something. So you have to convey to them that they're not as powerful as they think. If you simply concede, you're only going to encourage the opposition to ask for more.
So really, so your rule is don't give them an inch. They'll take a mile.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the word, I know it's a strange word in today's political atmosphere, but compromise is really the key to this, getting people to work together and say, I'll do this for you if you'll do that
okay,
for me.
Okay, that's not going to work. What else you got? Well, we always, you know, all we know about this is what we see in the movies. In the movies, like, there's this moment sometimes where the negotiator says, I know, take me and let the hostage go. So do you think Obama can, like, let Boehner have him in exchange for raising the debt limit?
No, once you give somebody that power, then they only want more because they don't value anything that comes to them too easily. So next thing they probably would ask for Pelosi and Reid.
Really?
Yeah.
we could be worse off. Gary Noesner is the former chief hostage negotiator for the FBI and author of the book Stalling for Time. Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Right now, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Luke, since it was announced Homeland Security would be abandoning its color-coded terror alert system, many have wondered what they would replace it with. Well, this week it was announced. What will it be?
They're going to pare it down to just two different states of alert. I think one is called imminent, and one is called soil yourself. I don't know what
It's not. It's not so much the statements. It's right. How they're going to transmit the warnings.
They're going to use social media.
Yes, they're going to use, in fact, a Facebook and pointedly a Twitter feed. The color-coded alert system has been removed because it was ineffective and it was always clashing with Janet Napolitano's autumn color palette. Now terror warnings will come via Twitter and Facebook. The 140 character limit on Twitter might be a problem. We'll get messages like urgent warning, attack imminent. If you want to survive, head immediately to. But it's understanding for this to work, right? You're going to have to join Twitter if you aren't on Twitter already, and you're going to have to start following the DHS. And that means that in between, like, the serious alerts, whenever they come, you'll have to endure all of, you know, Janet Napolitano's boring updates about her lunch. Great tuna wrap today. Threat level delicious.
But using Facebook is good because if anybody plants a bomb in Farmville, they'll get it.
Right away.
Kiri, researchers at Columbia University Medical Center announced this week that they've engineered mice to do what?
Is there anything that they haven't engineered mice to do already? They engineered mice to... Oh, they've got fat mice, they've got skinny mice, they've got mice that get old, and they've got mice that grow human ears on them. Is there anything that I need a hint.
Well, this is just one example of the many examples there could be. The mice still eat cheese, but now they choose low-fat varieties.
They engineered them to make sensible diet choices?
Well, that's part of it. Actually, in general, they engineered them to make better decisions. These are more sensible mice in general. Researchers at Columbia were tired of the lousy choices that their lab mice were making in their lives, staying up all hours, playing in the wheel, eating garbage as opposed to their regular food, which is actually garbage. So they developed a way to stimulate neuron production in mouse brains to help the mice learn more easily and make better choices. Scientists realized that it had worked beyond their wildest dreams when they returned to their lab one night to find a 10-foot-long spring-loaded trap baited with an iPad 2. Coming up, it's Lightning Fill in the Blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can click the Contact Us link on our website, waitwait.npr.org. There you can find out about attending our weekly live shows right here at the Chase Bank Auditorium in Chicago, Illinois. And check out the new podcast from the producers of Wait, Wait, How to Do Everything. This week, how to get out of dancing with someone you don't like. That's at howtodoeverything.org. Hi, you're at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Justin Huddick from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, how are things in great PDX?
PDX is great. A couple days of sunshine, now it's raining again.
There you go. Just to let you know what you're missing. What do you do there?
I work at a local college, George Fox University.
You work? That's unusual.
For Portland, it is.
Yes, I know. Justin, welcome to the show. Carl Castle is going to read you three news-related limericks. The last word or phrase will be missing each time. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly in two of the limericks, you will be a winner. Ready to play?
I am.
Here is your first limerick.
I'm a judge who can pack a mean punch. Of paroles I've denied a whole bunch. Oh, go cry in your hanky. I'm hungry and cranky, 'cause court times go right through my
lunch.
Yes, indeed. If you end up a prisoner and you're up for parole, you better hope your judge had a big breakfast. According to a Columbia University study, judges do not grant parole when they are hungry. The 1,000 hearings studied, 65% of the prisoners were granted parole in the morning, but that number dropped to nearly zero as lunchtime approached. After lunch, it went back up to 65% again. So if your hearing is scheduled long after breakfast, you better hire a lawyer from the firm of Pringles, Pringles, and Funyuns.
LLC.
Exactly.
Right.
Here's your next limerick.
My app has food mavens on salary. They take note of my lunch photo gallery. Whether deep fried or stewed, I take pics of my food, then hit send, and they count every
calorie.
Yes! Thanks to MealSnap, you can now take a picture of your lunch and get quantifiable numeric proof that the meal you're about to eat is going to kill you. This amazing app is here to prevent you and those around you from making terrible food decisions and to make you the most annoying and neurotic person at the dinner table. You know, actually, one of the producers at Wait, Wait got this on his iPhone and he pointed at me and he took my picture and he submitted it. And it took it about 10 minutes of, like, thinking, and then it finally said, not food. Here is your last limerick.
Telling zebras apart is a hard road, and I'm making mistakes by the carload. So I got this device that keeps track of their stripes and just scans them like they are a...
Download.
No, not quite, not quite.
Shoot.
We'll try again. Let's hear this limerick again.
Yeah, one more time.
Telling zebras apart is a hard road, and I'm making mistakes by the carload. So I got this device that keeps track of their stripes and just scans them like they are a...
Like you're in the store and you
barcode.
Scan... Barcode, yes! Animal biologists are finally taking commercial advantage of zebra stripes with a new program called Stripe Code. It's sort of a giant barcode scanner for wild zebras. Once an individual zebra's stripe code is in the system, you just run it by the scanner and boom, you're like, yep, that's Eric. Eric the zebra. It's particularly useful when trying to track migration patterns among zebras or when the line is shorter at the self-checkout.
The hard thing is getting the zebra up on the conveyor belt.
It's tough. Yeah. And the self-checkout's like, unexpected mammal in the bagging area. Your item is thrashing. Carl, how did Justin do in our quiz?
Well, Justin wins our prize, Peter, because he had three correct answers.
Well done, Justin.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for playing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
We have a tie for first place, Peter. Luke Burbank and Charlie Pierce each has 3 points. Kerry O'Connor has 2.
All right. Well, Kiri, you're then up first, so the clock will start when I begin your first question. Fill in the blank. Rebel leaders rejected an African Union peace plan and asked for more help from NATO in blank.
Libya.
Right. During interrogations in Cairo this week, blank was hospitalized after suffering a heart attack.
Hosni Mubarak.
Right. To kick off his reelection bid, President Obama held fundraisers in blank.
Chicago.
Right. After a 12-day trial, home run king blank was convicted on one count of obstruction of justice.
Barry Bonds.
Right. The actor best known as the Verizon guy revealed that at his grandmother's funeral, he overheard a friend mutter blank as her casket was lowered into the ground.
Can you hear me now?
Of course. Kind of cruel. Conservative critics were outraged after J.Crew published an ad featuring its president, Jenna Lyons, blanking.
Pink, it's a pink toenail thing.
Painting her son's toenails pink, right. ABC announced Thursday that it is canceling two of its long-running blanks, All My Children and One Life to Live.
Soap operas.
Right, to avoid offending anyone, third graders at an elementary school in Seattle will only be allowed to have plastic Easter eggs if they blank.
If they bring in a note from their parents.
No, if they call them spring spheres.
Oh, that's so irritating because they're not spheres.
They're not. They're spring ovoids, but that's not alliterative. Calling Easter eggs could upset people who don't celebrate Easter, not to mention all the poor chickens who have to watch their young mercilessly stuffed with chocolate. So instead we get spring spheres. Spring spheres come in solstice baskets. They're delivered by the generous Candy Rabbit, a good friend to other inoffensive childhood heroes like Winter Fat Guy. And the tooth-confirmed bachelor. Carl, how did Kiri do on our quiz?
Kiri had a great round, Peter. 7 correct answers for 14 more points. She now has 16 points and the lead.
Impressive as always, Kiri. Now, we flipped a coin. Luke has elected to go next, so here we go. Luke, fill in the blank. A month after the disaster in Japan, regulators have raised the nuclear crisis rating, putting it on the same level as blank.
Chernobyl.
Right. After a standoff at the presidential palace, the former president of blank surrendered and was arrested.
Ivory Coast.
Right. Reenactors gathered at historic battle sites to mark the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the blank.
Civil War.
Right. Arrests began Monday in France as the ban against women wearing blank went into effect.
Burkas.
Right. To get out of sentencing for her crime of forging prescriptions, a California woman showed the judge a blank.
A false piece of paperwork.
Yes, but it was a forged note from a doctor. Charlie Sheen and Warner Brothers gave conflicting reports over whether they had been in talks for him to return to blank.
2.5 Men.
Right. Bloomberg reported that Apple may begin selling white blanks at long last at the end of the month.
iPhones.
Right. In a shocking video, Czech Republic President Václav Klaus was caught blanking at an official ceremony.
Napping.
Stealing a pen. In the video, Klaus is seen taking the pen out of its box and admiring it, casually moving it under the table, and then returning his now empty hands to the tabletop. Czech staffers say, no, he's not a thief. He was acting within established Czech state protocols and cited as evidence the Czech coat of arms, which features a white, double-tailed lion slipping a stolen sword into its pocket. Carl, how did Luke do in our quiz?
Luke had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. He now has 15 points, but Kiri still has the lead with 16.
All right, so how many then? How many then does Charlie need to win?
7 correct answers.
All right, here we go. This is for the game, Charlie. According to a new poll, the percentage of Americans who have a blank dropped to the lowest level since 1983.
A job.
Right. This week, an appeals court upheld a ruling stopping the implementation of blank's controversial immigration law.
Arizona.
Right. The latest Republican to form a presidential exploratory committee is former Pennsylvania senator and Fox commentator blank.
Santorum.
Right. The Winklevoss twins, made famous by the movie The Social Network, have lost their suit against blank.
Facebook.
Right. A car chase in Florida took an unusual turn when the perpetrator took time out to blank.
Go through a drive-thru.
Right. Pick up some lunch. This week, People magazine named American Idol judge and pop star blank as the world's most beautiful woman.
J-Lo?
Yeah. Foreign dignitaries and former boyfriends and girlfriends of the couple were among the names in the guest list for the upcoming royal blank.
Wedding.
Right. A penguin at the Sea Life Center in Germany has fallen in love with blank.
J-Lo.
No.
Why not?
She's too tall?
What's wrong with that penguin?
A penguin has fallen in love with a rubber boot.
Please tell me it's platonic.
No, I hope so. The course of true love never did run smooth, and for Bonaparte the penguin in love with a black and white Wellington boot, it's even more difficult.
Wait a minute. Bonaparte fell in love with a Wellington?
Yes.
Hey!
Says his keeper, he rubs his nose in the boots and cuddles up to them. He gets very excited, showing off and trying to seduce the boot. Sadly for Bonaparte, the boot rejected his advances, reportedly calling him a heel.
He'd been seeing a flip-flop behind the penguin's back.
Carl, did Charlie do well enough to win?
He needed 7 correct answers to win, and he had 7 correct answers. So with 17 points, Charlie Pierce is this week's champion.
Congratulations, Charlie. In just a minute, we're going to ask our panelists to predict what poor Mitt Romney will do to finally steal some of Donald Trump's thunder and get some press. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Chase, offering the Marriott Rewards Premier credit card. Details at marriottpremier.com/radio. The National Association of Realtors, providing resources for homeownership at houselogic.com. And Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago, in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Goedeker writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our intern is Nick Park. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Dolarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Michael Danforth. Now, panel, how will Mitt Romney derail Donald Trump's crazy train? Luke Burbank.
New chief of staff, Gary Busey.
Charlie Pierce.
Magic underwear, garanimals.
And Kerry O'Connor.
Aware of his limitations of bringing the crazy, he promises to choose either Meatloaf or Charlie Sheen as his running mate.
Well, if Mitt Romney does any of those things, panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Luke Burbank, Kerry O'Connor, and Charlie Pierce. Thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal, and we will see you next week. This is NPR.